Okay, at this time we'll call the meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Time is 1:35 p.m. on Wednesday, March 9th. Members present are Representative Dick, Representative Wilson, Representative Foster, Representative Munoz, Co-Chair Seaton, myself, Co-Chair Feige. The purpose of our meeting today is to take up House Bill 60, Gooey Duck Aquatic Farming and Seed Transfer by Representative Paul Seaton, followed by HB 105, the Southeast State Forest, sponsored by the Governor. Representative Seaton will be presenting, assisted by his aide, Katie Koster.
Kester.
And there's also Jeff Regnart from the Comfish. And online for questions only, when we have to call him if we have a question because the bridge is down, but John Beattie, who's the Aquatic Farm Program Manager for DNR. So, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee. And for the record, Paul Seaton, House District 35, Seward, Homer, and adjoining or adjacent communities. And House Bill 60 is dealing with gooey duck clams and mariculture throughout the state. So to give everybody a little background, we have a very short little video that I'd like to play first.
What we have here is the siphon of a gooey duck.
There you go. That's what I'm talking about.
Someone comes in from Kansas, they haven't seen anything like that. God, that is an obscene-looking animal.
Now, here in the Northwest, there's a giant clam called a gooey duck. He's a tricky critter, and you really got to stick your neck out to get him.
The original word, gooey duck, or gooey duck, really, is a Nisqually Indian word, and it means to dig deep. It's referring to the fact that the gooey duck is down 3 feet and you need to really dig to get it out.
Going clam digging may seem strange for somebody who grew up in a kosher home in Brooklyn, New York.
You're just going to stab your up, you know, you want what you can't have. You know, he's a kosher boy. No clams allowed.
There's just all these ways that it's sort of permeated our culture.
You dolls are my friends.
Go, gooey ducks, go. Through the mud and the sand, let's go. Slapping high, squirt out, swivel all about. Let it all hang out.
The oldest one that I've got is 163 years old, so
I think we have to. They're very handsome animals. They're a pretty animal.
They have character, you know, their own. Some people, it's amazing to watch. Some people just are so grossed out.
Well, I don't know. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Yeah, it's a pretty hideous looking creature.
When you get when you cross a gooey duck with an owl, you get a 3 foot long muscle that stays up all night.
So you can tell that, Mr. Chairman, that gooey ducks are part of the culture of the Northwest. and Southeast Alaska also. They're native to Southeast Alaska. The reason for this bill is that what we're trying to do is provide an economic base for the Gulf of Alaska and communities all the way from Yakutat out to Sandpoint, around Kodiak, and places where it's very difficult to establish a new economic base. And geoducks from the farms are worth $12 to $15 a pound. They're sold live. And the very great thing as far as a economic development project about geoducks is that they're subtidal. It's not like oysters where you're having to take them and handle them three times a year and chip barnacles off and those kind of things. And it doesn't, you don't have to do anything during the peak of the salmon season or the herring season or some other time. So villages and communities and independent farmers can establish a economic base that doesn't conflict with the normal rhythm of economics in Alaska, in coastal Alaska. That's one of the problems. You always have this big contest between which thing will you do at the same time, because you can only do one thing at a time. But geoducks can be harvested anytime during the year. This bill extends the ability for farmers to get geoduck seed from the single hatchery. You can only get geoduck seed from Alaska. It cannot be imported from Canada, cannot be imported from Washington. They're totally a native species, but they really don't occur in the wild north of Juneau. And so what happens is that there are geoducks taken from Southeastern. They go to Seward, where the only certified hatchery is. That's the Aleutic Pride Hatchery, Shellfish Hatchery, Mariculture Hatchery in Seward, where they are bred. Water temperatures increase long enough to get them to spawn. Then they raise them to, you know, small seed that are then repurchased by the farmers, and they're planted. Generally, they're planted in a small piece of plastic pipe with a screen on the top, so that you don't get starfish or anything coming in and eating them, or birds, those kind of things when they're small. And then those little tubes are left on for about a year and taken off, and then it's about a 5 to 7 year time in which they grow to about a pound and a half, and they're harvested. What we've done in this bill is we've said it's only going to be allowed subtidally. In other words, there won't be any intertidal on beaches, so it's not going to interfere with people's traditional where they land their boats or where subsistence harvest takes place. Geoducks like a low-energy beach, very muddy, muddy kind of sand bottom, so they don't compete with razor clams. Or other hard shell clams, which are intertidal, that has a lot of energy on the beach. The only thing that is in the habitat that geoducks like are tunicates, which are kind of little wormy, kind of like a sponge, and then some worms, polychaete worms that can grow about this long. They're segmented worms, and that's pretty much in those low energy subtidal areas. That's what's there. Studies have been conducted to see if there was a decrease in the number of worms and those kind of things in those areas when you geoduck farm, and actually they found that there's a slight increase in the number of worms and others, because what you do is you break up the habitat. So you have not just a muddy bottom, but you have other things there. So there hasn't been any decrease in other fauna in those areas, and so that's the object of this, is to try and do that. Geoducks are very interesting. There have been no, they haven't found any diseases in geoducks. In fact, geoducks are really unusual because, you know, like you just heard, they can live to be 160 years old. And they actually, if there's something that's irritating and they move it right through, slowly through their tissue to the outside in like a little wart or something. So they, there's no known diseases, especially those of transport, they call them transport significant. So you don't have to worry about taking a gooey duck from one area and moving it to another area. There is, within the state, and in fact, all around, there's these areas that are called larval drift zones, or zones where you want to maintain the genetic integrity. And so you don't want to take a clam from one area and take it into another area because you might disrupt the local genetics. Well, what we're talking about here is taking clams to an area where there is no local population. So we don't have to worry about genetic contamination by moving gooey duck clams from southeastern to anywhere else in the Gulf of Alaska, because north of Juneau in the Gulf of Alaska, there are none of these clams. So it's a very highly prized species. They're sold live. They won't interfere with other animals. They probably will be non-reproductive, just like oysters are. Oysters, you know, you can take oysters from here, you can, and through the hatchery, or you can actually, oysters were grandfathered in statehood, so that you can actually import oyster seed from Washington and Oregon. But that would not be allowed under this bill. They can only come from Alaska stock. But when you take oysters up north, they don't reproduce. And that's been one of the very valuable things, is because they never reach maturity, they don't get bitter. Because what happens is with oysters, if you've ever had a bitter oyster, you know it's terrible, but that's because they're in the reproductive phase. And oysters, like up in Kachemak Bay, where around Homer, they never reach maturity, so you can market them year-round. So we'll probably have that same situation with gooey ducks if we go north of there, because just like oysters, they don't naturally occur up there. But obviously, since they raise them in the hatchery at Seward, they survive just fine.
Why do they not reproduce?
Generally, it's felt that they don't reproduce because the water temperature never gets high enough. They have to raise the temperature in the hatchery for an extended period of time above the temperature that you naturally see as you get up north. And so different animals spawn or become reproductive based on different criteria. Some animals do because of light system, you know, when it gets a certain light, what clams generally respond to is temperature in the water. And the water temperatures up north don't get high enough to start them into the spawn cycle. And so, anyway, the question has been asked, what would happen if they did spawn? And, you know, it's one of those things, the calculations were it'd make a $750 million a year industry for the dive fishery. There's no dive fishery because there's no clams up there. In southeast, there's a wild stock dive clam fishery. And you've heard, those of you that have been in the legislature here, have heard about all these gooey duck fights that have been in southeastern for years. And those fights have all been around the idea that you have a wild stock and now you want to have a farm in the middle of the wild stock, and you want to site a farm where you've got really good conditions, but of course where those conditions are, you've got a wild stock. So now if you start a farm, how many of those wild stock or clams that are owned by the people of the state can the farmer now harvest and sell? And so it's been this conflict between the wild stock and the farm. That won't occur at all up there because we're north and there are no wild stock clams. So all of those issues are pretty well resolved, as well as the one other thing is that we built the hatchery, the state did, in Seward, based on the idea that it would be self-sustaining, and it makes oyster and gooey ducks seed to sell to farms. However, since there haven't been farms north of Southeastern, they haven't been able to sell enough product, and we keep having to subsidize the hatchery every year. And if we develop a number of farms, then it should become self-sustaining because they'll have a source to sell. The geoduck seed is much more valuable than is oyster seed. So that's pretty much, I think, where the bill is, and why it's here is to doesn't change any of the parameters of permits. People still have to get their health permits. They still have to get the farm permits. They still have to have transfer permits and all of the things that are there. The only thing that this bill does is say that we won't deny people permits in the rest of Alaska or in the rest of the Gulf of Alaska just because there aren't wild geoduck already there. So it is an Alaskan species, and we're just moving, extending it.
You got two fiscal notes here. They're both zero fiscal notes. If because of geoduck, additional propagation, I guess, is that going to reduce our need to fund the hatchery as much then?
That's correct. That has been the problem because we have had to subsidize the hatchery because they haven't had the sales for enough farms.
Okay,
so and this will extend that, and the hatchery should become self-sustaining.
Yeah. I understand, but wouldn't that result in a fiscal note, a negative fiscal note perhaps, or a positive?
The
one way or the other?
Mr. Chairman, we're doing a normal the way this has been done. It's not built into the base. There's been some capital projects. It's been a capital item because it's not intended to be long term. So the hatchery,
you mean?
The hatchery. Okay. Funding the hatchery has been each year through an additional capital request item. It hasn't been built into the base. So it's not a normal thing, and we hope we will soon be able to get away from that so we don't have to request capital budgets to keep the hatchery going.
Okay. Representative Herron?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of probably related questions. First one is, what is the harvest window, and is that harvest window right before they change sex?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, the harvest window is whenever they want to go out and harvest them. There hasn't been
Mr. Chairman, I mean, you have to let them grow to a certain age. What is that? What is the optimum harvest window when they reach harvest maturity, I guess?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, it's generally 5 to 7 years. And like I say, the thing is that geoducks, once they get in the substrate, you can't pull them out and they don't dig back in. They're not like a razor clam where you can take it out and it'll dig in again. So they're sedimentary. They're in one spot. They're filter feeders. They don't go around and do anything other than sit there and suck in water and filter out the plankton and grow.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So evidently, when the hatchery was built, it was probably a little bit of a snafu like we have had, maybe like the what's up in Anchorage where we've got a cold storage that is not being used. And because if it was supposed to be sustainable, and it's not, but you can't have growing, nothing can grow there now, then it wasn't really sustainable to begin with, because that was to be used in Southeast, right?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, no, the plan all along and through a number of governors has been that mariculture would expand across Alaska. Part of the plan, the plan for the development of the hatchery was that they would be able to sell. There's been reluctance over time to allow geoducks to be farmed in the other areas, so it's been restricted to the area down here in Southeast. And then there was the problems that kept coming up between the wild stock and the wild stock harvesters and the farmers, and so it has delayed far beyond anybody's estimation the growth of mariculture in the state of Alaska.
How old is the hatchery?
It's about 10 or 12 years. I'm sorry, I don't have that
so it's,
particular date.
Okay, so it's 10 or 12 years old, and even if we pass this, which I suppose we will, but even if we pass this, we're still going to have to subsidize them for another 5 to 7 years or longer, because in order to hopefully, we're kind of doing an experiment to see if they will grow up there, because we really don't truly know if they will, right?
Through the chair. No, we know they'll grow up there. The question is, the only question that there has been is, will they become reproductive? Nobody thinks that they will be reproductive. They grow fine in the hatchery in Seward, but they don't get to be reproductive unless you raise the water temperature above the regular temperature. So, but they grow fine. So it's just like oysters. Oysters grow fine, but they never get reproductive. They never become reproductive, but we don't want them to become reproductive anyway, because they're planting seed and they're buying it. So it's not that we have to wait until you harvest before the hatchery can become self-sustaining. As soon as we have a number of farms that are buying seed and planting the seed, that will be what sustains the hatchery, is the purchase of seed from the hatchery, not the harvest of the grown out clams. So It's not the same as waiting on the farms to become fully self-sustaining on their basis, because they will have to be purchasing. It's about a quarter per animal is what they buy the seed from the hatchery.
Okay. Thank you. I can't imagine how it's not going to cost money, for the simple reason in Southeast, when we tried to get things started, it took a long time, and even now we'd like to have more areas that are available, but Fish and Game doesn't have the money to get people out to check these sites out and do everything that needs to be done. So it's really hard for me to think that we're going to be able to take some up there where they haven't been working, and have enough whatever to get them going. So can you kind of go into that?
Sure, and part of the big problem down here is you have to go out and survey and find out how many wild gooey ducks you have on the farm sites. There are no wild gooey ducks that will be on farm sites up there, because the gooey ducks aren't wild there. Okay. And so you eliminate that in part of the problem. Another thing that DEC has done on their water quality samplings now, before you get a farm site, they've actually gone and put GPSs on the boat, so that when someone goes out and takes a water sample, they can track when the boat's going out and coming back, so that they can know that that's where the water sample came from, so that there are finally mechanisms we're moving to lower the costs of getting those water quality samples that need to be taken over time and all. But it's going to be the purview of the, whether it's a village or whether it's individuals applying for farm sites on their own, they're going to have to make those costs and those investments. As a private industry, they're going to have to buy the seed. They can only buy it from the hatchery, because you can't import seed. You cannot legally go out and take animals out of Southeastern on your own and do that. They have to come through the certified hatchery, and the state has very good controls on that to make sure that we have high quality and safe, non-contaminated clam spat that are then sold to the farmers.
Yes, for now.
Okay. Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Paul. Does a Southeast seed get sold outside of Alaska, the gooey duck seed?
I don't believe there's any sale outside of Alaska. It's especially, it wouldn't be sold to like British Columbia or Washington, Puget Sound, because they want to make sure that they're not contaminating their local wild stock. So the genetics are such that when you want to take an animal, you take it from that small. In fact, they have much smaller area. They take it from that small area, and then it has to be replanted from the hatchery back into that same area. So I'm not aware of any permits, but Fish and Game could tell you. But I don't think that any other state would allow the importation of a stock to change the genetic composition of their wild stock.
So you had said that gooey ducks are only native in Southeast Alaska, but you were just talking about in Alaska, that there are other regions of the country that have native stocks as well.
Through the chair, yes, Representative Munoz, the little film that we just saw, Evergreen State College in Washington, that the gooey duck is their mascot. I can't imagine being with a college that had a gooey duck for a mascot. But anyway, apparently, as you can see from the video, people have a lot of fun with gooey duck. And but anyway, yes, they exist all over in Puget Sound and in British Columbia, and they come up through Southeastern. Tenneke Springs was the furthest north of their natural range as to where at least Fish and Game had identified that was the northern extent of their natural range.
And just one more question.
Go ahead.
And where is the product marketed? Japan, the United States? What are the primary markets?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, so the primary market is Asia, whether it's China or whether it's Japan, but it's a very highly prized seafood. People in Asia eat just about everything, and this is a very highly prized one. And the one thing that the farmers in Southeast have said is they would like to see other farms, because we have such a small piece of the market that we don't get the highest price because we can't supply on a year-round basis a lot of product. And so more farms would be helpful to everybody in the economic structure of things.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? What kind of investment does it take to start a gooey duck operation?
The sites and the surveys and those kind of things, I think we have somebody from the Shellfish Association here that could probably give you that. I'm not really familiar with that. There had been some questions because we have a number of oyster farms in Kachemak Bay right where I am. And just so everybody understands, that's a critical habitat area that has been defined that way. And when they formed the critical habitat, they didn't allow for on-bottom farming of clams. And they were really thinking about on the beaches, but that includes subtidally. So this is not something that would be done in Kachemak Bay because it's part of this critical habitat. However, the outer Kenai Peninsula and the villages such as Nunwalik and Port Graham, as well as down through Yakutat and all around Kodiak, those it could be a very good economic base for those areas.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you, Representative Seaton. See, next up, Roger Painter from the Alaska Shellfish Growers Association.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Roger Painter, and I'm president of the Alaskan Shellfish Growers Association. Now, I'd like to speak in favor of this bill. I think it's pretty straightforward. Representative Seaton did a good job in covering the basics. We look at it as an economic development tool. One thing I would stress is that the state has very stringent regulations governing the movement of shellfish in the state. Every time you move it from one place to another, it has to be approved by the pathology division and Fish and Game. So when a gooey duck is harvested in southeast and sent to the hatchery in Seward, it must come from a source that's been certified by the pathology division in Fish and Game. Before the seed can go out to the farms, it also needs to go through pathology. And if I were going to move oysters, say, from my farm to another farm, again, they would have to be tested. Very, very stringent controls. If you talk to the pathology department in Fish and Game, you would find that they believe that gooey ducks are one of the cleanest animals that they've tested. Very, very clean. And frankly, don't see any major concerns with the bill. And again, I think it's a good little economic development tool. It's a little unclear at this point just how well gooey ducks would do beyond southeast waters, but you don't know until you try it. And I just like to point out that in 10 years, actually about 15 years after the farmers in Washington State started working with gooey ducks, they've built a $20 million industry, and it looks like in the next 10 years that could either double or triple in value. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question was asked earlier, how much would it cost to get started? And that's to get started and get enough in the ground so that from the time you kind of get it in the ground to the time you can harvest, how much of investment is that?
The biggest problem with farming gooey ducks is the long time it takes for them to reach marketable size. Marketable size is about a pound and a half. The gooey ducks have been planted in southeast. They just made their first harvest this past year, and they're calculating it takes 7 to 8 years to reach that size. Most of the investment costs would be the purchase of the seed. As Representative Seaton mentioned, they're about 25 cents apiece. You probably need to plan on buying at least twice the amount of seed that of animals you need to produce. The only other costs you really have are regulatory costs, getting your waters certified for harvest, and paying the survey fees. If you're down in southeast, you have to pay $5,000 for the pre-lease survey to determine how many gooey ducks might be on the site. And then the other cost would be just the vessel and divers. So it's mostly the seed cost. So the total cost would depend on how big of an operation that you plan. If you were planning on trying to harvest, say, 10,000 animals a year, you would have to be buying 20,000 animals at least. And at 25 cents apiece, you could kind of calculate that up.
Well, if you were going to do that, you'd probably, if you want it to continue, I mean, do they start multiplying in southeast so that you don't have to keep buying seed? Or do you have to buy seed every year and plant it every year so that you've got the, so that once you start harvesting, you know, if I had a quarter of an acre here and a quarter acre here and like that, then you could plant it, and then you could harvest this one. The next year you do the one on round. Is that about how you do it? And so, but still, you didn't say any number, so I guess if they you plan to harvest 10,000 every year, what would, I mean, I know that the cost has got to be pretty high initially to get started. And, you know, I'm not asking for any rock-hard amount, but, $100,000 or, I mean, what is the number?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I would be guessing you would be in about that range if you wanted to have a good, profitable business. By the time you bought 8-9 years of seed, covered your vessel and diver costs, you would definitely be in the $100,000 okay. range.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Roger. Could you tell me what your permit fees are through ADF&G, and is there a period of kind of holding off until they're implemented pending the first production or the first harvest. Sorry. Do you have a period of time where you have relaxation from the permitting fees?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, we would sure like to convince the Department of Natural Resources to do that. It's very difficult when you're not bringing in any revenues to cover all those front-end costs. You're looking at not only all the capital investment you have, but your operating costs, paying your tideland fees, just getting your the water quality certified in your harvest area will end up costing the farmer about $6,000-$8,000. You start adding up the fees, those kinds of costs, and the state regulatory costs are considerable part of your front-end investment.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. The sponsor of the bill, Representative Seaton, has testified that the water temperature inhibits maturation or breeding. But I'm reading the letter of support from the Aleutic Pride Shellfish Hatchery, and they say the fact that it will probably be non-reproductive in South Central Alaska should make management easy. How confident are we that these stocks wouldn't be able to reproduce? Do you know?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, we don't know. We're guessing based on what's happened with other animals. The reason gooey ducks haven't spread up to southeast, past southeast, probably have to do with the currents along the coast. Once you reach Cape Fairweather, sort of the end of southeast, the currents, instead of following the coastline, go way out into the Gulf, take a very circular route before heading back towards Prince William Sound. And during that time, the larva from these animals is floating in the water, and it only can live for a certain period of time. So they can't really make the transition to the new water. So we don't really know how they'll perform, how fast they'll grow. It seems pretty unlikely that they would reproduce, but frankly, we're not 100% positive.
Thank you.
And I assume that your estimate is based on lab work that has been done at the hatchery?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. We have the hatchery has been producing gooey ducks now for well over 10 years. And so they have quite a bit of experience. And the waters need to be, temperatures need to be raised several degrees, and at considerable expense, I might add, to actually make them spawn. So it seems, based on that experience, it seems highly unlikely that they would spawn.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions from the committee?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Painter. Jeff Regart.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Jeff Regnert. I'm the Director of Commercial Fisheries. I think at this point we would just state our position again on House Bill 60, which is the Alaska Department of Fishing Game takes a cautious approach to farming. However, in this case, we don't see any significant risk with the passage of this bill. Thank you, sir.
Representative Wilson.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jeff, what permits do they have to get? I mean, the permits that they have to get to begin to start. Then after that first start off, and you've acknowledged or okayed all those permits and whatnot, and in the title fee that, and I guess that do the tideland fees are, is it state waters that we're looking at here, that so that they, that money goes to the state, or are they personally owned? And so, I mean, how does that work when they lease the land, number one? And then I want to know what they have to do every year after that and why, so we have an idea of how hard it is to get going with this.
And through the chair, Representative Wilson, I'll do my best. To be very blunt, I'm not that familiar with the permitting process. Part of what you're speaking to is a DNR permitting process as far as the tidelands. The department doesn't facilitate that.
He's from DNR.
Okay.
Yeah, we've got some folks online. That
okay.
So the DNR part I couldn't speak to. As far as what the department requires, I guess I'd ask Representative Seaton. He's very familiar with this, and maybe he can help out the rookie here. And
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. You know, we do have 1640-100. That whole section is the section that deals with aquatic farms, and there's, you know, the whole criteria for issuing permits, you know, looking at the biological characteristics. They look, first of all, at the biological characteristics of the area that's being applied for a permit, and they look at, make sure that there won't be significant interactions or disruptions of anything else. And then there's the aquatic stock acquisition permit, if you're wanting to get it, and that it pretty much goes to the hatchery and then the sale from the hatchery. And then there's also the transfer of stock. So if you want to move clams or seed from one area to another, you have to go through that, as well as the disease inspection. So there's an entire section that that Fish and Game uses for their making sure that whatever stock is being transferred, whether it's gooey ducks or mostly, you know, we're looking at oysters, because there's a lot more oyster farmers than there are gooey duck farmers. And so the oyster farm permits are there, and you know, they have to come out with DNR, and they have to have the corners identified and all of those things when they lease the land and everything else. So DEC is involved, as well as with the water quality, because the water quality has to be certified, because Again, this is going to be where you're going to raise something for human consumption, so DEC come makes a, it's over the course of a at least a year, in which they take water samples to make sure that you don't, you're not siting a farm in a place where you're going to have pollution. And that's one of the things about mariculture is beneficial because it requires good, clean water. And so you have the farmers making sure that things aren't happening to pollute the area. So I'm not quite sure if that answers your question, but those are the series of permits that are required.
Well, who owns the when they lease it, who do they lease it from?
State water.
So it's, it has to be state waters?
It is state water.
Okay. I don't know that.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, there's two things that you have to get. One is you have to get a DNR lease, which is because the state owns the subtitle lands. And so you have to get a permit, a lease permit from the Department of Natural Resources. And then Fish and Game controls the biological criteria. So all of those permits have to come through Fish and Game. But there is also the DEC, Department of Environmental Conservation aspect, in which they're looking at the water quality to make sure that the water is not polluted to where the site would be. So all three of those things have to be in place, and but the fees are paid to the state of Alaska, the lease fees, through DNR, Department of Natural Resources.
Representative Kalashak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now this might be a question for somebody else who's online, but can you tell me a time that you know of in which the commissioner of the department has denied a permit based on the absence of a wild stock?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, again, I'm not that familiar, so I don't know. If we've denied a permit, if one's coming in front of us based on that criteria.
Yeah, you can deny a permit of DNR or Fish and Game.
For Fish and Game.
Okay. And we can definitely find that out. So we can get back to you?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll do.
And then I guess.
Follow up?
Well, no, I guess the follow up won't matter if we don't know the answer. Thanks.
Okay, any other questions from the committee? No, take a brief at ease. Okay, House Resources called back in order. Online we've got Mr. John Thede from the Aquatic Farm Program. He is the Aquatic Farm Program Manager with DNR. So, Representative Wilson.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, have you been listening to this conversation as we've gone along?
No, I was just called just now during your recess.
Oh, okay. Well, we're talking about the gooey duck farming and starting up new gooey duck farms, and I have a few questions because I was asking the question of how much it takes to start up, and they went into that you have to get water quality permits from DEC and certain things from Fish and Game, and then certain things from DNR. Now, how much does it cost to lease tideland to do something like this?
Currently, for DNR, the first acre or partial thereof is $450, and for each additional acre, it's $125. So it just depends on the size of the farm.
Okay, thank you. Can continue? They pay that every year, forever, right?
Yes. Once they get through the process, it's a 10-year lease, so that's an annual fee.
Okay. Is there anything else that they have to pay annually? Because we know that there's so many years before they even get any kind of a profit. So do you know of any other fees that they have to pay yearly?
We have a list of all the fees in our application. It does cost them to get the water quality stuff done for Guiduck Fund. Well, this is, I believe this bill is to put, to farm Guiducks in areas where there are no Guiducks. So I'm not sure that Fish and Game would require a bottom survey, but they very well could. They do for on bottom farms. They have to get they have to have a survey done to see what's already there, so they know if there are any Guiducks there or any other, you know, things that might be affected by the farm.
Okay, thank you. And then once that's done, does it have to be done again?
Or? No. Okay. No, the Fish and Game survey is once it's done, they know what the biomass is and what kind of creatures are down there, and that's it. It's a one-time survey.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Thede? Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for being online. A question I asked earlier dealt with if there were any time in history that you know of in which the commissioner has denied a permit based on the absence of wild Guiduck stock?
No, I don't believe so. I've been in the program just about since its beginning, and I would say an on-bottom lease has never, you know, been applied for Guiducks outside of areas where there already are Guiducks.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
And Representative Wilson.
Thank you. I have one more question. Have we ever, or has the state ever leased areas to people and they never did anything, so you took them back, or do you have to wait the 10 years, and if they didn't do anything in 10 years, then you take them back, or how does that work?
Well, you may recall HB 208, that was a few years ago, the legislature asked the state to come up with X amount of oyster sites, clam sites, so we looked around the state and people nominated places. Then when I was hired to execute that program, I went through all of the files, all of the Guiduck permits at that time, not Guiduck, but shellfish permits at that time, and looked at each permit and why it was closed out. And if it was closed out for anything other than a biological problem like icing or bad circulation, the water was too shallow, it got too warm, whatever. If there weren't any biological constraints, then I reoffered those specific sites to the public in our over-the-counter program. So we have, there are times that people get into, not especially Guiduck farming, but the aquatic farm program in general, and they find out it's just too much work, I would say, is the main problem, reason people drop out, and then they just close out their leases. When they're closed out, again, if the site's suitable, if there weren't any problems with it biologically, then it is offered to the public again. In that specific spot, only for that size, because that's what's gone through the Alaska Coastal Management Program, through the permitting process, and so if anybody wants that site, they could get it, but they can't expand it unless they put an amendment, and then it would go back out to the public for comment and through the process again.
One more time.
Follow up, Representative
Wilson. Thank you. I know with our fishing permits that we have a lot of people out of state that own fishing permits, and I was just wondering what the ratio was for people that live in the state of Alaska versus the ones that live outside of the state of Alaska.
Oh, boy. There's not very many at all that are out of state. It would be, I know, off the top of my head, I know two people that are Seattle residents that come up, but I would say 99% of our, you know, 67 leases are in state.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for being online. Dealing with permits specifically, can you run down sort of the process by which you would give a permit for a shellfish grower or a Guiduck farmer?
Sure. We have an opening every other year from January to April basically. A person would hopefully call myself and the Department of Fish and Game and DEC and kind of do some background checking. We encourage them to do that. They apply, they put in their application. Hopefully they've gone out and done some research. Then we start the process. It goes through the Alaska Coastal Management Program, so it's advertised through them. We also require an advertisement to let the people know what's going on and what could possibly go on. There's a comment period. A preliminary decision is written by DNR, by myself, and then that goes out for public comment. Anybody that comments, we incorporate those comments into the final decision, and that the final decision is whether we, go forward or stop. The same with the Alaska Coastal Management Program. They do a consistency review. They come out with a preliminary review, take comments, and then they also come out with a final. If it's not found consistent with the coastal zone management regulations, then they can't go forward. So that's kind of the big hurdle. And then once the final is through, there's a certain amount of time, I think it's 15 days, that we wait and to make sure there's no appeal, and then the lease is issued. At the same time, Fish and Game is also looking at, they have a permit. We have a lease, they have a permit. They're also looking at the biological things with the project, and then they generally, we work in consort, so they don't usually deny if we deny, and we generally don't deny anyway. But they're looking at the biological constraints of the area, and then they issue a permit. Then after that, then they go for the water quality, which they can do at any time. But that, the water quality is really something that comes about when the product is ready to sell, because it has to pass PSP and, the pathogens and stuff. So that's something that comes in play a little bit later. I wouldn't say anybody's really taking a chance by not having a water quality before, because our water quality is so good up here. And I think, off the top of my head, that's pretty much the process. If we get all the, depending on the number of applications we get, if we get 10 or less, usually we can be done with the process they can get their leases in late fall or early winter so that they can order their spat and be ready to plant in the spring.
Okay. Follow-up, Representative Kowalski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Specifically on, thanks for being online, specifically on the biological study from the
Fish and Game,
the one that they perform, dealing with sort of introducing a non-native species into a new habitat. I'm just curious as to how much study goes into that before the final determinations are made to proceed with a permit.
Well, certainly that's a question that should be addressed by Fish and Game, but there has never been an aquatic farm put in for geoducks where geoducks have not been before, so I'm not sure what they would be looking at. I know that they're very concerned with invasive species, and that's one of the reasons they take a look at, or they would be taking a look at this very seriously. We have had, as you know, many invasive species, and one of the ways that they're transported is, by planting things in other parts. But otherwise, they're contacting their local biologists to find out what's already there, what this might impact, what kind of diseases they could spread, or invasive species. But really, that's a question that should be answered by Fish and Game, Cynthia Pringham, or one of the biologists.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Is there a provision in your regulation that allows the fees to be waived during the production phase until the first harvest takes place?
No. Not that I'm aware of, no.
I think it would be helpful perhaps to consider an option to have the fees due at the time of first harvest. Because one of the things we've heard is that the ongoing costs are very high, and that it's difficult to make these farms pencil out financially in that pre-production period. So I just ask that you take that into consideration.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, what's the average? I mean, it's $450 per acre for the first acre and then $125 after that. Can you give us an idea of what the average farm, how many acres the average farm is?
Well, it depends on the species. For oyster farms, very few are over 2 acres. They may have two, they may be paying for more than 2 acres, maybe 3 or 4, but generally 2 acres, if you think of the size of a 2 acre garden, it's the same size on the surface of the ocean, and 2 acres, if it's a one man operation or perhaps a wife and her husband or whatever, 2 people, 2 acres would be getting up there to where any more they'd need help. So most of the farms are, I would say, 1 to 2, maybe 3 acres. Gouiduc farms are larger. They're getting bigger tracts of land. They certainly haven't been utilizing that land as far as planting gouiducs. And gouiduc but it takes longer to produce a harvest. However, it's a one-time, they go down and plant. Not that they can do it all in one dive, but they plant and then they put predator netting over that. Then there really isn't any kind of intensive labor for the next 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. Whereas in oyster farmers, they have a little tougher in that they've got gear to buy, gear to clean. That's more intense.
So how many acres does a gouiduc farmer usually get?
Well, they can apply for whatever they'd like, but generally I would say they're between, I should have had this information, 10 acres, some of them are, 5 acres. Again, they're not utilizing that area, but that's how much they applied for. Generally, you know, gouiduc, it's really such a new, even though they've been out there for 9 years, it's a pretty new industry. So, for example, if a person would come in and apply for an oyster farm and say they want 10 acres, I would probably talk them out of it or try to, and try to convince them to start small, get your business going. There's no need to pay for extra land. Start with an acre. You can always amend your application during the opening and to enlarge it. But with gouiduc sites, you know, they all went out in the HB208, so they all went out all at once. We haven't had any new applications for them, and so it's a very small number of people that own all the leases for gouiducs, and so they chose 5 acres, 10 acres, whatever they thought they might utilize.
Yes. John, if I remember right, when that first came up for the gouiducs, there was there were several farmers that just bought as many as they could at the time. Have you gotten any of those back?
Yes, there's been a few of them that just didn't do anything. And there has been problems with the gouiduc farmers, too, because the spat has been difficult to come by. So there has been that lag. But the probably our biggest concern at this point, after the farms have been in use now, or the land has been leased at least for 8-9 years, we've got no data. We don't know what the growth rates are. We don't know how close they are to harvest. And we have, as an agency, just said, well, just keep going. We don't want to close you out. Just, you know, keep going. But now we're getting to the end of the lease, and we still have no data on any growth, on any mortality. So we're in a little bit of a quandary with the existing leases.
Thank you. Is there forms that they have to fill out every year, even if there's not anything going on, but to give you any information at all so that
absolutely.
You have?
Absolutely. Excuse me. Yes. They're required to complete an annual a use report to Fish and Game, and they asked the very questions of how much product do you have, how much product did you plant, how much product do you plan to plant, how many worker days were you there, how many workers did you have, what was your income, if any, and that is looked at in comparison to the 10-year operation and development plan that each farmer is required to complete and has to be approved at the beginning of the process. So we do look at those. However, you know, I can say we've been very lenient and probably haven't stuck our guns down and said, you guys have to fill these out better because it's a new industry and such. But there is a requirement for that. Some of the farmers do excellent, and some of them it's like pulling teeth every year. There are no fish tickets. There's nothing like the fish ticket system that we have for commercial fish. So, you know, they just put down kind of to match their development plan, I think, sometimes. But it's just the way it is.
I would think that you would need to start maybe thinking about doing something like the fish tickets so that you can get some counts.
Well, we've certainly talked about that in-house. There's a little resistance in the community because it's a burden upon them, of course, too. And, you know, but we definitely are talking about it.
Any more questions for Mr. T? Okay, sir, thank you very much for answering our questions.
Thank you very much.
And, Mr. Regnard, if I get you back up there, I just have a question for you. In the sponsor statement for this bill, it alludes to an informal policy of the Department of Fish and Game that prevents geoduck seed or geoduck seed from being utilized by farms anywhere outside of Southeast Alaska. What was the reason for that informal policy?
Mr. Chairman, I think it was for some of the things that have been alluded to as far as the invasive species and the concerns the department has in regards to that, where we might not or would not understand the effects of a species being introduced to an area that we've never seen them represented. And so really it's the unknown. And I think in regards to gooey ducks, what you've seen is that we've backed away from that a little bit. Again, we're urging a cautious approach to this, but that we would, you know, do our best to take a look at the effects and move forward with the permitting program, depending on what, you know, this body does.
Okay. Representative Kawasaki?
Yeah, thanks. I think earlier we heard testimony to the effect that the permitter said that there's never been a time that he knows of where the absence of gooey duck stock has been used as a denial for a permit. And I guess my question is, if we do change this so that you cannot use the absence of a gooey duck wild stock, would that hamper your ability to really do the due diligence necessary on a project or request for a project?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, no. We would still have our ability to go out and take a look at the pros and cons of a proposal. And, you know, with the resource best interest in mind, you know, go ahead with the termination. So I don't feel it would compromise our ability to do our job, carry out our mission.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Regnard. At this time, do any members of the committee have amendments that they're thinking of or ready for this particular bill?
Are we just a comment?
Representative Kawasaki.
Okay.
Well, I was going to offer a motion, but I'll wait.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment, and I think I've seen this bill now for the last five years in a row, and so it comes to no surprise that I've got some concerns over it, sort of the cautious approach. And I know that at the very beginning, the Department of Fish and Game was 100% opposed to it, and I know that the representative's done a lot to get it to the point where it's at now. I still have some concerns about it. One is dealing specifically with the invasive species aspect that we have discussed just recently, dealing with plant and aquatic life. So the question always is what – there's things that we can't prevent nature and we can't prevent global climate change from changing our climate here so that we have more invasive species. But to add an invasive – potentially invasive species into an area gives me great concern. Secondly, we've dealt with ESA issues and threatened species issues, specifically for wood bison up in your area, Mr. Chairman. And I don't want it to become later a hindrance where we're trying to develop another natural resource that competes with this natural resource. I'll cautiously support moving this bill today, but there's a Simpsons episode. I don't know if everybody's seen it. It's the Simpsons episode where Bart finds two eggs. The eggs hatch, and he finds out they're lizards, but he can't kill them because he has some sort of maternal instinct about them. So he lets them go. So these Bolivian tree lizards kill all the pigeons in the community, which is great. He gets an award for that, for eradicating the pigeon population. But then you've got this huge proliferation of Bolivian tree lizards. So the solution was that the mayor decided to call on the Chinese needle snakes, which are their natural predators, to kill the Bolivian tree lizards. And then the second part of the story was, well, how are we going to get rid of the Chinese needle snakes, which are suddenly invading everything? And the idea was to get snake-eating gorillas, and the snake-eating gorillas would most likely die when winter comes. So I just want to make sure that everybody's cautious when we're talking about these potential invasive species that are not native to an area, perhaps not invasive, but again, we don't know if they're going to reproduce, and I just wanted to make sure that the folks knew we proceed with caution.
Representative Seed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I definitely appreciate, you know, that, and I appreciate the caution. The thing that we need to remember is that this clam exists with the same species that we have all across in Alaska, all the same five salmon species, all the same, you know, echinoderms, and, you know, these, it's the same species mix. So it's not as if we are moving something into an unknown ecology, because this is the same ecology. They just don't go that far north, but the species of salmon do go north, the halibut, the black cod, all those other things, and the species of algae and everything else that are circulating here within South Central and Southeast it's a very similar ecosystem. And so I just want to say that although we want to be cautious, I don't think that this raises to the kind of the attitude of something that Brazilian tree lizards or whatever they were that migrate from one place to another and eat things. These are, again, clams that are going to be in the substrate, and they filter out of the water, and hopefully they won't be chasing the gorillas. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm confident that the Department of Fish and Game will be making decisions based on the Simpsons. So, Representative Munoz.
Thank you. I'd like to move House Bill number 60, version A, with attached zero fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Hearing no objections, we'll move it on out of committee. And in the interest of time, while the paperwork's being passed around, next bill we'll consider is HB 105, and we have Mr. Rick Rogers from the he's the Forest Resources Program Manager in the Division of Forestry and DNR. Also, off-net, we've got Marty Parsons available for questions. If you could pull him up and just have him available. And let him know that we can't mute him. So he should be careful what he says. Rick Rogers here?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Rick Rogers. I'm the Forest Resource Program Manager for the Alaska Division of Forestry. When this bill was previously heard, our director, Chris Mesh, presented. He's out of state, and I'm filling in for him. I'm very familiar with the bill and have worked in developing through its initial conception. So I'm pretty much here just to answer any remaining questions there may be about the bill. And Chairman, I also have some additional background information based on the public testimony at the last hearing. There was quite a bit of discussion on the issue of domestic processing of logs off of state land versus export, and so I'm prepared to provide some information with respect to that as well.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, at the last, at the public testimony, you'll recall there was concern, and as well as expressed from some of the committee members, on whether or not logs from the Southeast State Forest would go overseas on the round without an opportunity to support our local sawmills. I prepared some data. It was actually a very interesting question. We hadn't really looked at it through that lens in the past, and so we went back. And for our southern southeast area, which is the area office out of Ketchikan that encompasses the both the existing and the proposed new lands for the Southeast State Forest, we looked back 6 years and concluded that 87% of the logs from state timber sales remained in the state for manufacturing. And so 13% of the logs were exported, and of that 13%, 3%, or about a quarter of the logs that were exported, were actually exported by sawmills. And the reason for that is there's a wide range of log quality, and there's a, the real high-grade logs, oftentimes, even from the sawmill's perspective, will have more value exported in the round than they would if they were manufactured. So the sawmills will actually ask us for variance under their contract requirements to export a small percentage of their logs. Typically, they'll pay a higher stumpage for that material, and then they're allowed to do that. But I think in balance, I think the data demonstrates that we're doing a pretty good job encouraging local manufacture of timber off state lands. If you look at the same question statewide, the numbers are even better because the bulk of the export market is in southern southeast. So we look at the same time period statewide, and we found that only 5% of the logs are going out of state in the round.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Kawasaki. Yeah.
Just to clarify that point, because it was brought up, you said that 87% over the last 6 years have been processed within the state before export. I heard the 87%.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, 87% of the logs are manufactured by sawmills or processors in Alaska. The other 13% would leave the state in the round without significant processing.
And so, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, can you explain out of the 87% that are the sawmill does something to them? Can you tell me what sort of added product do we get out of the sawmill? Are they sent out? I don't know wood. So, are they sent out as 2x4s? How are they processed? What level of processing occurs within that 87%?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, it varies quite a bit. The past practice under the long-term Forest Service contracts, the early days were primarily producing cans. So they were very crude processing where anywhere from 8 to 12-inch cuttings were made, and then large cans were then sent overseas for secondary manufacturing at mills. That situation has changed quite a bit. The Viking sawmill, our largest remaining sawmill, is producing finished products. There is some material that may be resawed, but it really varies by mill. There are some mills that are also providing secondary manufacturing, so they're planing and have kilns. It really varies. Now, in the northern part of the state, a lot of our material is actually going for fuel wood, particularly the hardwoods, and that's a very growing market given the price of energy in rural Alaska. So in that case, processing may mean something as simple as cutting and splitting firewood for home use as cordwood. So it's really all across the map, and I think the most important take home is for us to see additional investment in any type of manufacturing, whether it's primary or secondary value-added processing. We need a reliable supply of timber to make that happen. And unfortunately, here in Southeast in particular, with the dominance of federal land and what we've seen happen with the supply off federal land, we're not seeing new investment in manufacturing because it's just too much risk involved without having a reliable supply to amortize your investment.
Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Of course, except for above Bethel, most of my communities live on the tundra, so timber is very valuable, mostly driftwood. And so with this bill, we're doubling the size of the state forest. Is there different harvest practices on state lands than what a lot of people perceive as clear-cut and past practices in the Congress?
Through the chair, Senator Herron, the Alaska Forest Resources and Practices Act is what guides timber harvest on both state and private lands in Alaska. The standards for state land have a higher standard for riparian buffer retention. In Southeast, in particular, anadromous fish and salmon, of course, are another extremely valuable resource to Alaska. Timber harvest on state land and in the state forest or out of the state forest requires a mandatory 100-foot no-cut buffer on each side of salmon-bearing waters, and that includes everything down to a small coho rearing stream that might only be a foot or two wide with small rearing fish. There's an additional 100 to 300-foot zone beyond that that's a special management area where special consideration has to be given to water quality and the impacts it may have on that stream. In addition to that, the land management plans for state land provide some additional guidance, and in the lands we're talking about, they're guided under both the Prince of Wales Area Plan and the Central Southeast Area Plan. Both of those documents, it may vary somewhat by parcel, but just to generalize, they'll have a 500-foot no-cut zone along the coast. That serves a number of purposes, both for habitat, wildlife habitat, as well as visuals, as well as typically eagle nests occur in the coastal areas. There's typically a 330-foot radius around any known eagle tree. So I think we have some fairly good, very good protections and a very credible program to balance the state's interest in managing timber along with these other resources.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you. At the last meeting, it was stated that 8.3 million board feet is the target that you're looking at in the state forest for allowable harvest. And I was wondering what the actual demand need is requested by the existing sawmills, and how close does that come to meet the two or three mills that are in operation now?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, that's a very good question. What you're talking about is the annual allowable cut, and we are required by our Constitution to manage our timber in a sustainable manner. So that number comes from our inventory and our calculation of growth and yield, and essentially the 8.5, I can't remember exactly, I'm sure you have it right, that is a sustainable output of timber from this land base that we could harvest in perpetuity. That is nowhere near meeting the demand for our existing sawmills in Alaska, and certainly is not sufficient to provide additional growth and investment in new mills. Just to put the 8.5, I don't know what the annual production capacity of the Viking mill is. I think on two shifts it's probably close to 50 million board feet a year, but I'm just guessing on that. What's, I guess, somewhat frustrating about this situation is, given the state's land base, I think this bill represents the state doing what it can to help the situation on timber supply, and yet it's not enough to really overcome the supply issues that the industry faces. But that's really a function of what the land entitlement is for the state of Alaska. And we think this is a very good balance of those lands that the state did receive for Southeast Alaska. It's a good balance, and it's a good package to support the industry.
Thank you. Okay, just for information for the members of the committee, I'm going to continue until about 3:15, just to try to make up for our delay earlier. Representative Dick, then Representative Seaton.
Just a quick comment. You know, in the interior, a trip on Google Earth would show you. I understand the idea of you can't cut within 100 feet of a dam and stream, et cetera. But all the trees we have are only within 100 feet of, you know, the rivers and the streams. So basically, that regulation means no logging at all, because there's nothing beyond 100 feet. The trees are about that big. So just for information's sake, that. I think basically what that does is encourage poaching.
Through the chair, Representative Dick, the riparian standards that I quoted are actually for coastal Alaska, and we do have different standards in the interior that are somewhat more permissive because the biology is different. But I recognize your point, and it's a balance between protecting important water quality and fisheries issues and managing the timber. But we do, in spite of our riparian protections, have a significant underutilized allowable cut in interior Alaska.
Follow up for Representative Dick.
If I could just talk to you sometime about that, because I do need to clarify. Thank you.
I'd be glad to. Thanks.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I just want a little clarification. The lands we're putting in here are already available for cutting under the designations. They are what the purpose of this is, to put them in so that there can be pre-management of those on a more of a rotation cycle, but we're not taking lands that are not available for cut and putting them into a cut situation. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that is correct. These lands under the area plan designations are what are called general use category, which allows for timber harvest. These are the lands that we've calculated the allowable cut that Representative Munoz was referring to, and these are the lands that we're already actively managing timber sales on. There is one small exception. One of the parcels is in selection status, and it's currently being adjudicated at the BLM, but it too has already been planned for in the Prince of Wales area plan and has a general use designation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned that 87% was used in state, and I'm surprised. I didn't realize that was a possibility, and I know that a lot of folks think that a lot of natural resources are purely just exported out, so I'm really pleased to hear that. Doubling the size of the state forest, though, do you anticipate that 87% in-state use will continue, or do you think if we double the size, are we doubling it just so that it becomes complete export, round log export?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, as Representative Seaton's question suggests, it really doesn't make a difference in terms. These lands are already part of the timber base that we're managing. What could make a difference in the future is whether or not we can maintain our existing sawmills to have the processing capacity to process the timber. And one of the purposes of this bill is to give us the certainty in the long-term tenure of the lands so we can do more aggressive management. We can actually increase our allowable cut if we can grow the trees faster. And if we know that the lands will be managed as a state forest, it makes more sense to consider practices such as pre-commercial thinning, whereby we could conceivably more than double the allowable cutoff these lands over the long term. It's not going to happen overnight, but over the course of a rotation, we could actually manage these lands more effectively and support more processing by doing so.
Hey, Representative Gardner, do you have a question?
Thank you. It's actually along the same lines, and I think my understanding of this bill actually has been very much assisted by what you've already said, but what we're saying is the lands are already all available for cutting. Passage of this bill makes them more a different kind of management, including pre-commercial thinning. Can you just kind of expand on the management changes? And
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, certainly. If the lands are designated general use under an area plan as they are today, the state in the future could sell the land. The state could do a subdivision. It could go into some other use. And so to invest capital money in pre-commercial thinning, for example, if you have that level of uncertainty, I mean, are we in it for the long haul? I mean, that's kind of what we're deciding by this bill. Are we committing to growing trees on these lands, subject to all the other multiple-use considerations, because they're still multiple-use lands, but for the purposes of forest management, are we looking out over a rotation with the certainty that if we invest today, try to grow the trees faster by implementing good silviculture, that we'll be able to go back on another rotation and harvest that timber again? And so it's a commitment, and it's been through a filter internally with DNR. We don't have lands in this package that the Division of Mining, Land, and Water felt strongly that should be reserved for subdivisions, because that also is an important mission of the state and through the land disposal program. But we've taken kind of a surgical look, tried to pick out those lands that are suitable for growing trees, are not suitable for those other purposes within the constraints of the other protections we've talked about for salmon habitat and other public resources, and that's the lands we're looking at in this package.
Thank you.
Does that help?
Yes, yeah. It does.
Okay, thank you very much. Next one up, the Bob Klaus. We got about 6 minutes or so to go.
All right, thank you, Chairman. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
You didn't hurt the furniture, did you?
I hope not.
Okay.
My name is Robert Claus, C-L-A-U-S. I work for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. And thank you for allowing me to testify this afternoon. First off, we do support small mills and microsales and the ability of people to make a living on our forests through value-added processing of timber products, but we believe that the public lands should remain in multiple use and not be a timber first priority as they are in the state forest. Most of the parcels in this state forest are areas that we don't find controversial, and they do support the especially small mills in Thorn Bay, where people can just drive to the along existing road systems to get the timber they need to keep their mills going. There are a couple of the parcels that we do object to. One is Rowan Bay, and one is Hook Arm on the west coast of Doll Island. And the reason that I'm here today is because I live on Prince Wales Island, and I use the west coast of Doll Island and the west coast of all the outer islands of Prince Wales for hunting, fishing, recreation. My friends do. The tourism industry in our town, our small town of Craig, uses that area for their businesses to keep going, and we don't think that that particular parcel is Hook Arm would be a good addition to the state forest. We think that should remain multiple use and not be logged, so those business activities can continue.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there anybody else would like to testify on House Bill 105? And with that, we'll close public testimony on House Bill 105. Resources Committee will adjourn at this time. We'll reconvene at 1 o'clock Friday in this room.